The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Thursday, February 10th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a bit of news for you this morning. It is being reported by CNBC and NBC that Mubarak will speak tonight and will step down. Now, this, of course, is not confirmed, and things are changing quite quickly, and it's unclear exactly who will replace him. I'm seeing reports on my Twitter feed that the military prevented Mubarak from handing it over to his number two. This is the retail torturer, Suleiman. And so we still don't know. And I have to tell you, folks, that what's happening in Egypt, even if this is untrue, it is clear that Mubarak is going to go. He is going to have to go. This revolution that has been taking place over the past 3 weeks has been nothing short of stunning. And in the past couple of days since this guy, Ghanem, has been released, this 25, 30-year-old kid, basically. I don't know how old he is. He looks pretty young. Who started or was one of the architects of this Facebook movement over a year ago that has now turned into a full-blown revolution on the streets of not just Cairo, but across the country of Egypt. It's just stunning. And we have some sound of an interview that he gave on CNN last night. And I have more reports for you. But I have to tell you that this is, it really is amazing. And in some regard, it's very frustrating for me. We wanted to have some Egyptian experts on over the course of this week. It's very difficult because we're competing with television, frankly. We simply don't have the resources to bring you the type of coverage I would like to do. So I hope that the coverage that I have been able to bring to you, all, of course, you know, secondhand, just reading of other people's reports, be they on Twitter or in the paper or via the web, has been at least giving you a sense of the timeline and how this is happening. It's incredibly inspiring. Who knows what's going to happen in the near or mid or long-term future for Egypt. But what is really clear, and over the coming weeks and months, we will be talking about this more, that this is a movement that started on Facebook and started amongst the youth of Egypt. Of course, the impetus must have existed in the society, and we're seeing this now, but the will to actually bring this to the forefront, to actually have the rubber meet the road, as it were, it came from the youth, and it came from their number one means of organizing and communicating, which has been the internet. And before we get to these cuts of this interview with this Google executive who I guess is, I presume he'll have a job when he gets back, but who knows? I mean, who knows? There are reports now, and we have been talking about how the Egyptian military has at least seemingly been a neutral observer to everything that's been going on. over the past couple of weeks, particularly in Cairo. But for the most part, it's been our understanding across the country. There are new reports, however, as reported in The Guardian, that the Egyptian military has secretly detained hundreds and possibly thousands of suspected government opponents since mass protests against President Hosni Mubarak began, and at least some of those detainees have been tortured. This according to testimony gathered by The Guardian. The military has claimed to be neutral, merely keeping anti-Mubarak protesters and loyalists apart, but human rights campaigners say this is clearly no longer the case, accusing the army of involvement in both disappearance and torture, abuses Egyptians have for years associated with the notorious state security intelligence, but not the army. We will hear more about that as this progresses, but from the very beginning of these protests, from just 2 weeks ago when we spoke to Heather Hulbert about this, she said, you know, watch the military. This is one of the most important institutions in the country. And they may be attempting to consolidate some type of control as Egypt moves forward without Mubarak and perhaps without Suleiman, the retail torturer who we have outsourced much of our torture in from this country, and presumably he's been doing this, and as reported, as head of this intelligence agency in Egypt. There, I mentioned yesterday, there were reports of labor strikes across the country. We now have a more clear indication of what was happening yesterday. Thousands of workers throughout industry, education, and transportation joined Egypt's popular revolt on Wednesday. This provided by the Seattle Times News Service. Railroad technicians, teachers, sanitation workers, many others took to the streets as part of these impromptu labor rallies. Egyptians have been infuriated by newspaper reports that the Mubarak family has amassed billions, perhaps tens of billions of dollars in wealth, while according to the World Bank, about 40% of the country's 80 million people now live below or near the poverty line of $2 a day. The government announced a 15% pay boost for public servants earlier in the week.
I don't think so.
But some workers who joined the protest Wednesday said they couldn't be bribed out of joining the uprising. Arabic-language satellite TV channels reported as many as 200,000 workers were on strike Wednesday, a figure that could not be verified, but much of the information about strikes was disseminated via bloggers and on social networking sites without attribution. In one of the flashpoints of unrest on Wednesday, some 8,000 protesters, mainly farmers, set barricades of flaming palm trees in the southern province of Assiut. They blocked the main highway and railway to Cairo to complain of bread shortages. They then drove off the governor by pelting his van with stones. Hundreds of slum dwellers in the Suez Canal city of Port Said set fire to the part of the governor's headquarters in anger over lack of housing. In Cairo, hundreds of state electricity workers stood in front of the South Cairo Electricity Company demanding the ouster of its director. Public transport workers at five of the city's roughly 17 garages also called strikes, demanding Mubarak's overthrow. They vowed that buses would be halted on Thursday. Sanitation workers demonstrated around their headquarters in Dokai. Several hundred workers also demonstrated at a silk factory and a fuel coke plant in Cairo's industrial suburb of Helwan, demanding better pay and work conditions. In Luxor, thousands are hurt by the collapse of the tourist industry marched to demand government benefits. More than 2,000 workers from the Sigma Pharmaceutical Company in the city of Quesna went on strike, while 5,000 unemployed youth stormed a government building in Aswan demanding the dismissal of a governor. Just stunning how these popular protests in Cairo have unleashed the fury of the middle and underclasses in Egypt. And this interview with Ghonim, performed by CNN's Ivan Watson, apparently it ran on Parker Spitzer last night, Watson at one point asked him, were you deliberately hiding your identity? Yeah, of course, of course. Not just for the safety, because this is not about me. I don't want this to be about me, but in reality, this is not about me, and because I don't want to be the face of this. One of the things that the regime would do is just burn my face, and that's it. These guys made the plan. Who are we meeting? How are we going to surprise them? The plan was really smart, I have to say. Those who were experts said, we're going to go into rural areas, and we're going to talk about demands that connect with people's lives, and we truly believe in these demands, like the minimum wage, like talking about the end of unemployment, reducing unemployment, or at least giving people some sort of compensation to make a living. He says, I don't agree with the Muslim Brotherhood movement. I don't agree with their ideologies. But whoever these are, they are Egyptians. These are good Egyptians. They participated. Would say 10 to 15% of the people are there. They are just like Egyptians. They are honest and nice. They are not as bad as evil as they are trying to tell us. Here is him talking about the internet aspect of this revolution. This is clip number one.
Did you plan a revolution?
Yeah, we did.
What was the plan?
The plan was to get everyone in the street. Number one is that we're going to start from, you know, poor areas. Our demands are going to be all about what touches people's daily life.
There's been a lot of speculation about Muslim Brotherhood being involved in this uprising. How would you describe yourself and your friends who helped mobilize for the first protests on January 25th?
Muslim Brotherhood was not involved at all in the organization of this. Muslim Brotherhood announced that they're not going to participate officially. And they said if the young guys want to join, if their young guys want to join, they're not going to tell them no. If you want to free a society, just give them internet access. Because people are gonna, you know, the young crowds are gonna all go out and see and hear the unbiased media, see the truth about, you know, other nations and their own nation, and they're gonna be able to communicate and collaborate together.
Was this an internet revolution?
Definitely, this is the internet revolution. I'll call it Revolution 2.0.
Maybe not the best way to brand it, 2.0. Harkens back to, but be that as it may, I mean, this guy was in the midst of it. And with the notion of the Muslim Brotherhood being one of these specters that people are concerned about, and we've talked about this, there is reason for concern, but there was a poll that just was reported in the Washington Post by Adam Serwer, commissioned by the Washington Institute on Near East Policy. Suggests that the Muslim Brotherhood isn't anywhere near as popular as either Mubarak or paranoid conservatives believe them to be. This is not a Islamic uprising, says the poll's top line. The Muslim Brotherhood is approved by just 15%, and its leaders get barely 1% in a presidential straw vote. Asked to pick national priorities, 12% chose Sharia over national power, democracy, or economic development. And frankly, I think that if we were to take a poll in this country as to how many people want fundamentalist Christian control over our government, we would see a number higher than 12%. Asked to pick national priorities. Asked to explain the uprising, economic conditions, corruption, and unemployment, received 30 to 40% each. They far outpace regime not Islamic enough, which is only at 7%. Surprisingly, asked two different ways about the peace treaty with Israel, more support it, 37%, than oppose it, 22%. Only 18% approve of either Hamas or Iran, and a mere 5% say the uprising occurred because the regime is too pro-Israel. Now, that issue of Hamas or Iran is relevant because Egyptian Muslims are predominantly Sunni, Iran is Shiite, but Hamas is predominantly Sunni, or almost, I think, totally Sunni. So, you know, one can never be sure about a poll like this, but there may not be as much to fear. And when you hear from this guy, this kid, clearly he is in no way representative of anything other than a tremendous amount of Western values. Here's clip number two, where he explains how this thing has progressed.
I just posted that on Twitter yesterday. this is no longer the time to negotiate, unfortunately. We went on the street on 25th, and we wanted to negotiate. We wanted to talk to our government. We were, you know, knocking the door. They decided to negotiate with us at night with rubber bullets, with police sticks, with you know, water hoses, with tear gas tanks, and with arresting about 500 people of us. Thanks, you know, we got the message. Now, when we escalated this and it became really big, they started listening to us.
And again, as I speak, there are reports that Mubarak will speak tonight. It's not clear. There were some reports that he had gone to Sharm el-Sheikh. He may be there now with his top general. There are so many conflicting reports at this point that it's hard to say. But what is clear is that these protesters are not going to stop. And what is not clear is what's going to happen on the other side of this. Here is just a sense, and this is a long clip, but it is it really gives you a sense of the cross section of people in Egypt who are uprising, and this is a very moving part of this interview that was on CNN. Let's play this clip number 3.
Your arrest, do you think it was just a coincidence, a sweep of the streets, or do you think you were targeted?
No, I was targeted, of course. They wanted me.
What was going through your mind at that moment?
I was super scared.
You were blindfolded?
Yeah, blindfolded, of course.
For the whole time?
Yeah, of course. Today I was giving the complete power of attorney to my wife, everything I own, my bank accounts, everything, because I'm ready to die. There are tons of thousands of people there ready to die.
You gave power of attorney to your wife because you think you may die?
Yeah. Of course, they gave us a lot of promises about, you know, gradual change and so on. But then going back to the interview that Omar Suleiman did a couple of days ago, he said that Egyptians are not ready for democracy now.
What do you think of that?
So I think this is actually our real problem with the regime. Just the fact that, you know, you get some few people to decide that they are of a better, you know, of a better position to decide for a nation. And then use, you know, media to brainwash people, use the baseball bat to hit those who are, you know, who decide that they want to say no.
Do you feel any responsibility?
No. I'm sorry, but I don't feel, you know, I'm sorry for their loss. I can't forget these people's photos. I still remember them. This could have been me or my brother. And they were killed as if they, you know, if these people died in a war, that's fair and square. You know, you hold the weapon and, you know, someone is shooting, you know, and you died. But no, none of them. And those people who were killed were not, you know, were not like, they did not look like they are, they did not really look like, you know, they're going to attack anyone. They were just shooting them. They were shooting them a lot of the times the people were, you know, stand on, you know, the policemen would stand on the bridge and shoot people down. This is a crime. This president needs to step down because this is a crime. And I'm telling you, I am ready to die. I have a lot to lose in this life. I work, or, you know, now I'm on a leave of absence. I work in the best company to work for in the world. I had the best wife, and I love my kids, but I'm willing to lose all of that for my dream to happen. And no one is gonna go against our desire. No one. And I'm telling this to Omar Suleiman. He is gonna watch this. You are not gonna stop us. Kidnap me. Kidnap all my colleagues. Put us in jail. Kill us. Do whatever you want to do. We are getting back our country. You guys have been ruining this country for 30 years. Enough. Enough. Enough.
So that is Jael Ghonim on CNN last night, being interviewed in Cairo. Again, all sorts of different reports coming as to what Mubarak's going to say, where he's going to be saying it from, whether the military is handing it over to Suleiman. Whether it's a soft military coup, no one is quite sure. But we will keep you updated. We're going to take a break. Later in the program, we'll be talking to Jamie Court of Consumer Watch. We'll be right back. All right, we're back, just changing pace just a little bit. I don't know if you saw the pictures, you probably have, but it seems a Republican congressman from upstate New York has a real affinity for taking topless pictures of himself flexing. And I got to say, looks like he works out. Congressman... Oh, excuse me. Sorry about that. I should say ex-Congressman Christopher Lee, an upstate New York Republican who recently began his second term, resigned last night just hours after Gawker reported that he had sent a shirtless photo of himself to a woman he met on Craigslist. Oddly enough, that's actually how I sell stuff around the house. Got an extra dehumidifier. I take my shirt off. I take a picture of me holding the dehumidifier, shirtless.
How's that work?
I've done quite well on Craigslist selling those things. He said in an email statement that his resignation was effective immediately. The New York Times said the resignation came after Gawker published the email exchange that Lee, who is married and has a son, had with a 34-year-old Maryland woman he had met through Craigslist. I get the sense it's not his first exchange. Apparently, he was lying, saying that he was a divorce lobbyist. And the woman Googled him. And found out, like, wait a second, he's not a divorce lobbyist. He's actually a married congressman. And the best part is that Bonaire had to go talk to him because they have made it clear that there is a zero tolerance for personal misconduct. We'll see about that with Mr. Bonaire. But this is our second resignation from Congress since it has began the 112th Congress. And so far we're at two resignations, zero legislation. Well done. Meanwhile, the GOP seems to be in disarray at this point, which is good because it means they can do less damage. And now this won't last forever. And sadly, the Democrats also seem to be in somewhat of disarray. But it's always easier trying to block legislation than to actually pass it. Politico reports that the House Republican majority has already had two failed floor votes and is experiencing a backlash on the right over spending cuts and has bypassed the committee process it once praised for taking up major bills. And that's all just this week. The miscues indicate that House Speaker John Bonaire. Now, you wonder why I've said in the past that John Bonaire, that when you hear reports of him drinking too much, when you hear reports of him cheating with lobbyists, and by cheating, I don't mean just the typical Republican cheating of, you know, taking money from lobbyists and doing what they say. I mean also physically cheating with a female lobbyist. When you hear these reports, I have suspected that this is the Republican caucus trying to get rid of him because he seems to be quite inept. And it seems that they're having a tough time dealing with the nut jobs that were elected in their Congress, their caucus. Remember, this is a Frankenstein that they have created. And speaking of nut jobs, I've just received word that Kyle, Senator John Kyle from Texas, will not seek a fourth term. So that's always a nice I think there's very little chance for a pickup there, but it's nice that they have to defend another seat in terms of retaining the Senate. The latest problem for Republicans came Wednesday afternoon as Republicans failed to pass a mostly cosmetic measure that would attempt to recover $180 million in U.S. funding from the United Nations. Because, you know, you got to do that because of the one world conspiracy that's taking us over. We're all going to lose our guns. We're all going to have our bodily fluids sucked out of us, poured into the United Nations building in New York City. In fact, that's the way that they heat that building. They don't use conventional heating methods to, I hope all of you know that by now. The way the United Nations building in New York City is both a heating and cooling mechanism is done by our bodily fluids. They take our bodily fluids, which are at something like 98 degrees Fahrenheit, somewhere in that neighborhood. They run it through their a heat transfer pump, and that's the way that they do heat. And then, of course, they just reverse the process to get air conditioning. A day earlier, more than two dozen rank-and-file Republicans defied their leadership and defeated an extension to the Patriot Act, despite frantic lobbying by GOP Whip Kevin McCarthy of California and committee chairman on the House floor. There is going to be a revote today. It's not going to be under a rule that requires two-thirds vote, so it will pass, sadly. Remember, a majority of Democratic congressmen voted against this. Thank goodness for small but futile gestures. There has also been internal concerns about the GOP messaging operation and the inability for the party to tout job-boosting legislation. I'll say,
surprise!
How can you have job-boosting legislation when your only goal is to cut the only way to stimulate an economy mired in the recession that we're in, which is, of course, government spending? The learning curve has been exacerbated by the lofty promises of House Republicans that they made in the run-up of their taking over the chamber. Bonaire and his top leaders suggested they would move bills through committees and allow an open, transparent amendment process.
Hey, what happened?
Not a single bill has been sent through a committee in a regular order, and Republicans held the Patriot Act vote open beyond its 15-minute window Tuesday night because they were trying desperately to get their freshmen to vote for it. So we will see a vote on Thursday, which is today, and presumably they'll have got their new freshman in line. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jamie Court of Consumer Watch. Many more stories to get through today, so you want to stick around for the flip side. That is the post show, which will be open only to Majority Report members as of next week, mid-next week. Make sure you email us if you have a problem paying. Otherwise, join up at majority.fm. Do not forget that you can also support this program by buying coffee at justcoffee.coop, by putting Majority in the coupon code. You can donate your Twitter account for a day, a week, or once a month at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Of course, all these links are at the majority.fm website. And if you buy anything through Amazon, through our link, we get a little piece of it. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. It's Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Oh. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program Jamie Court, consumer watchdog, president. He is an award-winning and nationally recognized consumer advocate. His latest book, The Progressive Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For. He's also the author of Corporateering, How Corporate Power Steals Your Freedom, and What You Can Do About It. That I don't even know if we need to say any more. That's basically it. I mean, that is the story, isn't it, Jamie?
It's been a story for, unfortunately, a decade, but I think we're feeling the consequences. You know, I wrote that book in 2003, Corporateering, and we talked about how outrageous it was that people were using their homes, you know, like commodities, and how there was this change in culture and how banks were putting people into, you know, enormous credit card debt and basically getting them to turn their homes into cash registers. And I think, you know, we're all living in the aftermath of the government's failure to intervene in that crisis. So,
I'd add, not only did they not intervene, but it's been reported today that that 2005 bankruptcy law that was sadly championed by not only by Republicans, obviously, in the majority, but guys like Joe Biden, who was the former senator from MBNA, Delaware.
Yeah, and that's right. And he got a very nice deal on his house in terms of his mortgage, as I recall. But also, you know, the president, when he was a senator, to the chagrin of myself and many other progressives, supported that bankruptcy rewrite, you know, which, you know, at the
time. I mean, I think technically, I think what he did is he didn't stop. I think he didn't vote for the I think he voted for closure, but I think he voted against the law, if I remember correctly.
As I recall, he voted for two bills. My memory could be faulty, that were really disappointing. One was he voted for a limit on class action lawsuits, which is, of course, a way to hold corporations accountable. And he, in some way, voted to support that bankruptcy law. I thought it was the final vote, though.
I'm not sure about that, but either way, what he certainly failed to do was to uphold his promise that he made many times to support a cram down in a in the 2009 credit card bill. And that cram down would have solved many, if not not all, but certainly many, many, many of these foreclosure problems that we're having.
Well, yeah, and you know, we have a theoretically a federal system. I mean, this is probably the biggest disappointment. You know, promises that we're going to get renegotiations of loans, that we're going to allow, you know, the president wanted bankruptcy court judges to be able to rewrite mortgage agreements, which would be a big help to working people and non-working people who just need some intervention from these ridiculous rates. And he couldn't get that through. But I'll tell you, to me, the biggest problem we face right now is that in Washington, there's such a deaf ear to the suffering going on, you know, in America, you know, across the board, and bankruptcy court. I mean, you know, it has changed so much. So it's very easy, obviously, for GM to get it back on its feet and profitable and getting the government's help real quickly. And yet we have average people who worked all their lives and got into really bad mortgages with adjustable rates, and they're not even getting, you know, forget the help, you know, through bankruptcy judges trying to get them back on their feet and getting them back to paying taxes again. But, you know, they're not even getting help getting out of these ridiculous loans because we've turned a blind eye. And I just, you know, I just saw the budget cuts that were proposed by the Republicans today, and I, you know, it's staggering. You know, women, infants, and children, you know, program. I mean, this is for kids who can't get enough nutrition. I mean, we're really in danger of creating the type of conditions that, and this isn't an exaggeration, but the type of conditions where we have young people who aren't coming out of college, not getting jobs, coming out of high school, unable to get jobs. You know, getting to the point where the government's not going to help them. There aren't jobs for them, and we're going to start to see a lot more, particularly as student fees go up with state budgets, and it's harder for people to sustain college. We're going to start to see some of the street protests that we're seeing around the rest of the world, and it might be in a different proportion. But I feel the makings of a real turn, and it's probably based more on, you know, generation than anything else. And maybe that's a force for progress. Maybe it's a force for reaction. But I think it's coming. And if we don't start to prioritize the people of this country and their economic social needs. You know, we are going to see you know, Liberation Squares type of protest being repeated in America again and again.
You know, I want to turn to your work in the healthcare field, and particularly in California, in just a minute. But I want to stay on this for just one moment. You know, and I share that same sense that there is just the amount of angst and economic angst that is growing in the country and seems to be growing unabated. And I think we'll continue to grow unabated because, you know, we're seeing a rise in corporate profits, but we're not seeing any jobs come in. We're seeing we're on the verge of what can only be described as major austerity program implemented by the Republicans and, frankly, by the administration to some extent, or at least with some of their cover. What can we do to make sure that we're able to harness this this angst and turn it in a way that will be will provide more economic justice rather than one that can create a certain amount of the type of anger that we're seeing on the Tea Party side, where it becomes nationalistic, where it becomes very narrow in terms of and in looking for a scapegoat, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I deal with in the Progressives Guide to Raising Hell. You know, I think we need to take on these issues where we have, you know, 60% popular support for progress. And on healthcare, you know, we have 24 state ballot measure processes where the people can vote for initiatives, they can legislate themselves. And this is something we've had tremendous success with, and I talk about it, you know, the Progressives Guide to Raising Hell. 20 years ago, we had mandatory health auto insurance laws in California. And there was no regulation of how much auto insurers could charge. So you had people in the inner city paying literally $7,000 to $10,000, are being asked to pay $7,000 to $10,000 for an insurance policy, and if they drove without it, they'd be in prison. And so we passed an initiative based on that type of anger by the young, and even, you know, by others as well at their high auto insurance rates, called Proposition 103, that passed over $60 million insurance industry campaign to pass at the ballot box. It's the toughest regulation of the auto insurance industry in America. It's lasted over 20 years. According to the Consumer Federation of America, tremendous savings, $62 million for motorists here. We basically say insurance companies can't raise rates unless an elected insurance commissioner allows them to, and groups like ours and the public can stop them, turn insurance into a public utility. And I see similar situations with health insurance reform. I think there's anger on both sides of the aisle. I think the president clearly betrayed campaign promises when he endorsed mandatory health insurance, and because he put the government in charge of saying, everyone's got to buy a health insurance policy. And if that holds in the courts, there's going to be some opportunities at the state level. We're certainly going to pursue them in California, both to rein in all the profits of the health insurance industry, but more than that, we're going to offer the public a public insurance option, what we couldn't get in Congress. We can do that at the state level, and we can do it in 24 states where there are ballot measure processes, and we can build through the state ballot measure process, the type of progress that you just can't break through in Washington, apparently.
What happens if the Supreme Court, I mean, because ultimately these cases about the Affordable Care Act are going to end up in the Supreme Court. What happens if the Supreme Court actually does rule that the mandate is unconstitutional and at the same time allows it to be severed from the rest of the bill? I mean, as far as I can tell,
that's a great scenario.
That's a great scenario, isn't it?
It's the best possible scenario.
Explain to people why.
70% of the public opposes mandatory health insurance, and that's across the board in poll after poll. People won't be told to buy something from health insurers they hate and whose prices aren't regulated. So I think this is a ticking time bomb for Democrats if it stays in the bill, because by the time it hits in 2014, they're going to anger a lot more than the Tea Party fringe. They're going to get, you know, Democrats, progressives angry when they see their health insurance bills rising, you know, 40-50% a year, and they're being told by the government they got to buy it when they have to choose between that and tuition for their kids in college. I mean, the Democrats shouldn't be in the position of being a collections agency for the insurance industry, and that's where they are now. So if the Supreme Court relieves them of that, and the very strong pro-consumer protections and the rest of the bill remain intact, that is the biggest victory I think the White House and progressives can hope for. The danger, though, is that the Supreme Court takes out consumer protections that are tied to mandatory health insurance, which I don't think they need to do. But the Republicans are pushing to have the whole bill nixed. I don't think that's really a likely scenario, but I think it is potentially, I think it's possible that the Supreme Court will say, well, you can't force people to buy or to tax them for not buying a private commodity like insurance. But the bill was hinged on the fact that, the insurance industry only accepted the notion that they'd have to sell policies to everyone regardless of their pre-existing condition if everyone was forced to buy the insurance policy. And so we're going to strike down both the mandate and then provisions that force the insurance companies to sell to everyone regardless of pre-existing condition, that force the insurance companies to sell to everyone and price based on something other than their medical condition. Those are really important consumer protections. If we lose those, then a big chunk of what's useful about that bill goes. Now, states like New York, actually has this requirement that insurers have to sell to everyone. People can't be charged based on their medical condition, and there's no mandatory health insurance. So you can do this. It's been done, and premiums are relatively high in New York, but they're experimenting with premium regulation. In Massachusetts, there's a mandate that people have to buy, and, of course, insurers have to sell to them regardless of their medical condition. The prices in Massachusetts are higher than the prices in New York with the mandate. I don't think the mandate brings down health insurance premiums. It does bring down the number of uninsured, but that doesn't necessarily translate to savings for the consumer. So I think, the Supreme Court could do just about anything with this law, except I don't believe they can strike the whole thing down. I think that's way overbroad. I think if they take out the mandate, they could take nothing else, or they could take a lot of other provisions that are close to it, and that could be a big problem. So states like California, we're talking about going to the ballot box and keeping what we like in the law. So, saying that insurers have to sell to everyone regardless of pre-existing conditions, saying they can't price you based on medical, putting those provisions that are in danger back in the state statutes without the mandate, just in case the Supreme Court does that. That's something we'll probably embrace.
We just have a couple minutes left, but I notice you're doing work, obviously, on the massive premium hikes in California. Mm-hmm. And I became aware of it, frankly, because I had three or four members of the members-only club of this show for the podcast, who basically said, look, I would love to continue my membership, but I just got this retroactive bill from Blue Cross, and I can't, it's either this or food. And so tell us about what's been going on there.
Well, health insurers have been raising rates steeply. We had the biggest increase I've ever seen. Blue Shield, not Blue Cross, but Blue Shield tried to raise rates 59%.
That's
and it's just
stunning.
Stunning. It was worse than that Anthem Blue Cross 39% increase last year that the president seized on to finish the health reform drive and say, look, we can't accept this. And he actually got some traction on it. So we have managed, all the insurers have agreed, including Blue Shield, to freeze rates for 60 days while the insurance commissioner takes a look, but he's got no power to stop the rate increases. So Blue Shield was not going to do that. Other insurers in the state were going to take that 60-day freeze until we showed up with the California Nurses Association, about 300-400 people out at their doorsteps, and they agreed actually at that moment to freeze rates. So they must have felt a little guilty. But after 60 days, so that would be it was 60 days from March, so we're talking about May, these increases go into effect. What's basically happening is Blue Shield's becoming the poster child, and these rate increases are becoming the poster child for the need for really strong premium regulation for turning the health insurance market into more of a public utility. The insurers are going to fight us in the legislature, but we've got some legislation. If we lose in the legislature, we'll go to the ballot box. But this is a war. And mandatory health insurance with that 2014 deadline to be forced to buy or pay a tax penalty, is creating all sorts of havoc with the market. And at the same time, insurers are trying to take advantage of it to raise rates and get them as high as possible. And so I think we're going to see some conditions where, the public here in California is clearly ripe to vote to rein in the insurance industry and to give a public option to the people.
Well,
and we're going to do everything we can within the federal law to limit the insurance industry and also to give people an option. And I think if we do it in California, you know, we're talking about the seventh largest economy in the world, we're going to be able to export that other places, and the public option might be a little less scary. So we have, you know, the good fortune of having a very progressive state, very progressive leaders, and very at a ballot measure process. And we are going to try to pioneer, you know, the next evolution of health reform. Instead of going backwards, we're going to try to move it forward.
These things tend to spread from the West. It's been always been, whether it's been skateboards or ballot initiatives. Jamie Cort, it's consumerwatchdog.org.
Yes.
And people can go there and get more information, see how they can organize. And, of course, the book is The Progressive Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For. That will be up in our Majority Report book store within moments, is my guess. Thank you so much for joining us, Jamie.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We will come back on the other side, the flip side, as it were. This flip side will be members only in about a week, so you better get on the ball. Join up at majority.fm. And I've got some programmatic news, some marinatic news, and a couple of stories that we have yet to get to. Just too much news, ladies and gentlemen. Too much news. We'll be right back. You can IM me at Majority FM. Majority FM on your IM chat client. Stick around. All right, we're back. So the New York Fed reports that this 2005 bankruptcy bill led to hundreds of thousands of unnecessary foreclosures. You will remember, I remember how much we were talking about this bill, how destructive this bill was going to be. It was strongly supported by Republicans, bank lobbyists, and Joe Biden, and a couple other Democrats. It forces households with higher incomes who file for bankruptcy into a means test that does not allow them to discharge their unsecured debts under Chapter 7, but puts them into Chapter 13. In other words, it used to be if you went into bankruptcy, and the idea behind bankruptcy was you'd get a second chance. You'd ruin your credit rating. It would be much harder for you to build credit, but you would get some unsecured, which is what the definition of unsecured is. Debts essentially wiped out. That's what every single Republican wants the states to do and cities to do and towns to do and counties to do to their pension funds. Cancel them flat out. To people who have no chance to recover from having their pension funds destroyed, they want to allow, and it happens all the time with corporations that go out of business, they can basically just say, we're not going to pay. We're in bankruptcy. We don't have the money. We're not going to pay. We're not going to meet that obligation. But if you're a homeowner, you have credit card bills, you will not be able to discharge those debts. That was the law. They were not allowed under the new reform to modify, judges that is, the terms of a primary residence mortgage. No cram down. Barack Obama, on multiple occasions, promised when he got into office, they would push through a bill with cram down. It wasn't there. Jamie Cort said that, Obama supported it, but the bottom line is he didn't push for it. And this is not a hindsight opinion on my part. You can go back. I can't remember when it was. Summer of 2009. I sat on Campbell Brown's show. I think it was to talk about how Bill Maher had written some piece about Obama, deserting progressives. And I said on that show, the real test is going to be whether or not Obama fulfills his promise of advocating as hard as possible for the cram down. The cram down would allow a judge to look at your circumstances and essentially lop off part of what your principal was owed in that mortgage. He did not fight for it. He failed that test. He got an F. That was the first sign that something was amiss. Maybe it wasn't the first sign, but it was the biggest and most important sign up to that point. Under the new rules, bankruptcy filers under Chapter 13 are not able to cram down auto loans either. So basically, you had all these things. You couldn't get rid of your credit card debt. You couldn't cram down your auto loan. You basically would go into bankruptcy and you'd get very little relief. And David Dayan reports at Fire Dog Lake that this was not just speculatively potential, but that the president of foreclosure.com wrote, people get in over their heads by further encumbering their homes with equity lines of credit that are exhausted with purchases of consumer products and services such as cars and expensive vacations. Then when interest rates rise and home values stop increasing, he wrote this, I should say, back in 2005. They can no longer refinance and file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition to wipe out their unsecured debts and hold off foreclosure by their lender. Now they must file under Chapter 13 and pay off their debt in 60 months or less. Middle income families in this position could face the loss of their homes. Business Wire, April 25th, 2005. And what do we see today? The New York Fed basically says, not basically, says that this pushed more than 200,000 people into foreclosure and exacerbated the subprime mortgage crisis. And there you have it. Although borrowers have been unable to alleviate mortgage debt in bankruptcy since 1993, they remain able to discharge credit card debts by filing for bankruptcy. But in 2005, the law made it much more difficult to do so. By contrast, banks had long been able to dramatically increase consumer debt burdens without a borrower's consent at the time the bankruptcy law was passed. In other words, they had a practice known as retroactive rate increases. You accumulate debt at your credit card. I got a low credit card. It's only 6.5%. Look at me. I'm going to be, I'll be fine. And then the bank just decides, oh, incidentally, we're raising your rate on all that money that you borrowed from us. Now, in 2009, Congress passed a law banning that, but that's where they did not impose the cram down. And this is the wonderful. This is just lovely. While the New York Fed economist noted that the increase in foreclosure rates was predictable at the time the law was passed, they stopped short of calling for its repeal. The economists contend that since people now know that consumer debt is really hard to discharge in bankruptcy, they'll not take on as much debt and end up in financial distress.
Come with me and you'll be
50% of bankruptcies happen because of medical liability. That is usually dumped on a credit card bill. Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist, predicts another 2 million foreclosures expected in this year, adding to the 7 million that have occurred since the economic crisis of 2008.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, oddlay, oddlay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, oddlay, oddlo.
Ho, ho, lady of the lake, ho, 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 lady of the lake.
This break sponsored by the corporatists in Washington, D.C. Say you have a moral obligation to pay off your debts, but corporations aren't people. They have no morals. They get some other rights. They just don't have the obligations like morality.
Men drinking beer with a foam afloat, hurdlay, hurdlay, hurdlay.
And also brought to you by the corporatists in D.C. who are so concerned about the deficit. For no rational reason. Oh, let me rephrase that. For no rational reason that would protect the public at large. There's a perfectly rational reason if you want to upwardly distribute income to be worried about the debt, the deficit, to the extent that they're worried about it. There's a perfectly rational reason if you want to essentially steal money from workers that they have put into Social Security. And there's a perfectly rational reason if you're ideologically against any type of regulation, any type of government intervention in an economic catastrophe. That's rational. It's despicable, but it's still rational. And speaking of despicable, President Barack Obama wants to cut because he has bought into this. You know, Juan Cole, I was over there looking at stuff for the recap on Egypt, and he had a great quote. Maybe we should pass a law that says that you cannot become president if you still have absent daddy issues, as Obama and Clinton did. Because then you'd be less inclined to look at the billionaires and millionaires who surround you and look to them as if they were all-encompassing daddies who knew everything. You know, which, oddly enough, is very similar to that quote that guy whose name I shall not say, but that guy who said, look, Obama is completely bought into the idea that the meritocracy works, that these guys like Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and these and Pete Petersons know what they're talking about because of his beginnings, because he grew up believing in the American dream and the meritocracy so much that he cannot see that these people are jokers, that they're the type of people who get C's and cheat at tennis, was the quote. And this guy happened to come from that social strata and said, I know these guys. I don't hold them on a pedestal. Barack Obama wants to cut $2.5 billion from a $5 billion home heating aid program for the poor. Two people familiar with his 2012 budget proposal said Wednesday, halving the popular fund as he looks for places to rein in federal spending. The proposal would cut the low-income energy assistance program to its 2008 level of $2.5 billion. So people will die because of this cut. If it's enacted, people will die. There will be, an elderly person in Chicago. There will be an elderly person, maybe in Boston, maybe an elderly person in Buffalo, perhaps maybe a baby in, somewhere in Ohio. Who will die because of this budget cut. That's the cost of doing business, folks. What are you going to do? And separately, House Republicans on Wednesday outlined a plan for $35 billion in immediate spending cuts that would practically eliminate that program's contingency fund, cutting it by $400 million. I mean, honestly, why do you need a contingency fund? We all know the temperature is always the same. We all know that there are not extreme high and lows. We all know that cold snaps never happen. If the $2.5 million runs out and it's a really cold winter in some place, what are you going to do? Maybe we'll be lucky enough to have that scourge. That evil man in Venezuela who has nationalized, what is it? It's Citgo, right?
Yep.
Maybe we'll get another price discount. He set up something with one of the Kennedys in Massachusetts to give low-income fuel. Maybe we can get another subsidy from Venezuela. That's pretty pathetic. House Republicans sketched their vision for a smaller federal government Wednesday, as reported by the Washington Post, proposing sharp spending cuts that would wipe out family planning programs. Ah, well, what are you going to do? Take 4,500 cops off the street and slice 10% from a food program that aids pregnant women and their babies. Look, folks, we all know how much those blood-sucking pregnant women, and obviously, by definition, their parasitical babies, have done to destroy this economy. We all know how much they've benefited from all these tax cuts. We all know how much they benefit from the from customs officials raiding website aggregators to protect the property rights of corporations. Come on. 10%? Let's make it 20%. Let's cut the whole thing. How many pregnant women need to be malnourished before we would bring it back? How many babies? It's just stunning. It's stunning. And the door has been open to these cuts. And then they're going to come after our Social Security. I mean, I think Jamie Cord has a point. It's probably going to come from the youth. If you're 55 years old and you're out of work, you can't afford to get arrested. If you're having to work 80 hours a week because you're dealing with incredible medical bills, you can't spend time going out on the street protesting. I don't know. I think I'm going to get a little more adept at Facebook. Because this is just the beginning. Key Republicans are proposing to defund Obama's high-speed rail initiative, which they announced yesterday. $53 billion, was it, for high-speed rail? That coming on the heels of that WikiLeaks revelation that Saudi Arabia had overstated their reserves by 40%. Whoops.
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
Always helps to have a nice a non sequitur there to deal with this type of stuff. I don't know what to tell you. It would. They want to slash clean energy programs, gut the Office of Science by 20%.
Surprise!
And cut the EPA by 17%. You know, folks, one of the ways to deal with these austerity programs is to make sure that we have a decreasing lifespan. Because if we can live a shorter years, we're not going to need Social Security. We just won't get there. Now, the asthma or the brain damage that we'll have suffered from things like mercury or the asthma we'll suffer from pollutants in the air, or perhaps maybe our spleens will explode if we have enough PCBs. This is all, at least it's a holistic program. And leaders of the Conservative Republican Study Committee are vowing an alternative spending plan that would make good on a campaign pledge by House Speaker John Boehner to reduce government spending this year by at least $100 billion. You see, they want to sink this economy. And I think that they will. It's just a question maybe of pacing. They'll sink it really fast. Got other stories. We'll have to get to them tomorrow because I'm going to take your IMs now at Majority FM. Majority FM. John Kyle not running, says Nefer Kitty. Yes, Kyle is Arizona. My apologies. Did I say Texas? I was thinking of Cornyn. You know, there are so many nut jobs out there in the Republican.
Who can keep track?
Who can keep track? It'll be interesting to see. J.D. Hayworth, it would be interesting to see if J.D. Hayworth wins.
Yeah.
Because J.D. Hayworth wins, there could actually be a good shot at a pickup there. Because J.D. Hayworth is not only one of these classic, real nut job Republicans, he is also as dumb as dirt. Was he a football player? A boxer? Was there some reason why he might have some type of serious brain damage? And you made me spit my tea out all over the computer screen with the heating the UN with our bodily fluids. I hope you have insurance for that, because we cannot cover that expense. Which is worse, absent daddy issues, or am I going to best my daddy issues? Good point. I was lucky. My daddy was around. He was a dick. Treated me like an a-hole. What do you got?
He was a sportscaster.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Probably a color.
Tim Johnson, what can one buy for a dollar in the Dollar Lunch District? Oh, well, take us through that, guys.
There's pizza.
You get $1 pizza?
There's a place across the street from that place where you can also get dollar pizza.
That's right. There's at least two places where you can get dollar hamburgers.
It's true.
Dollar hot dogs.
Dollar hot dogs.
You can get a bagel for a dollar. No cream cheese.
Yeah, no cream cheese?
No, you got to pay extra for that.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Get a dry bagel for a buck. I got to say that pizza is not bad. We have that a lot in this office.
I'm a little embarrassed to have it.
Dos Hermanos.
Dos Hermanos pizza. And that other place across the way, not so great.
Not so good.
And sometimes I'll splurge. I'll get the bean salad at Guy and Gallard. Is that what it is?
I think
so,
yeah.
For $2.75. And I've been known, if I have no other expenses that day, I'll pick up a $5.95 sandwich, the chicken cutlet sandwich over there at Guy and Gallard. It depends. If I've filled up my coupon card with a free cup of coffee, on that day is the day we'll get sandwich.
A Cedarista member means you can eat turkey that day.
That's right. How many Cedaristas did we get today? I'm going to eat turkey. I'll have meat for lunch. Mark Green says, Sam, I'm struggling with a moral crisis. I want to become a Majority Report member, but years ago I swore to myself I would never, ever do anything that might benefit you in any way. I've got tons of money, but I also get sort of a thrill pissing you in the... Excuse me. But I also get sort of a thrill pissing in your eye. So I want you to give me a free membership. I will consider anything less than a French membership a grave insult. Mark, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Heathen Steven. Are Americans too complacent, too well off, and too small democratic to stage Egyptian scale protests, or too deluded to the true nature of our representation in government? Well, you know, this guy, Gonim, is extremely wealthy, I think. He's a Google regional manager
for the Middle East.
Living in the United Arab Emirates with a pool. Now, I have no points of reference.
I think they just give pools out.
I've spent so little time in the United Arab Emirates. In fact, I've spent no time in the United Arab Emirates. But my sense is wealthy. But I don't know how, but he sounds like he's a wealthy guy. And, the real question is the youth and in this country. I mean, I don't know. I think there's a certain complacency.
I think there is a sense that our system works to a certain extent.
I think there's a sense that our system works to a certain extent. And I think, frankly, there's a certain co-optation that takes place. But who knows? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever get there. Emiliano Alvado, just throwing it out there. Why can't I get a cram down on my student loans? It's pretty obvious these degrees lost their value in the ever-powerful market. Hayworth was a sportscaster. Oh, those two things. That's a good point.
I would love that right now.
Student loan cram down?
Yeah.
That's a good point. Torresy 80, did you read today's op-ed by Matt Miller, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress? There's a crucial fact. Ugh, this is going to get me fucking really... Oh, I was trying to cut down on my swearing. We're in the post show.
It was only one thing.
This is going to get me really annoyed. This line itself. There's a crucial fact that few liberal defenders of Social Security chastity understand. Jonathan Alter said almost the same thing, that same type of thing to me. The program now promises hefty increases in benefits for future retirees. Increases that are built into Social Security's formulas, just as with New York's unsustainable Medicaid rates. And these increases will be a major threat to other liberal priorities in the years ahead. I'm not talking about the way benefits are hiked each year to keep up with inflation, no problem there. But under current formulas, the starting benefit levels slated to be enjoyed by future retirees are substantially higher than they are now. The bottom line is, it does not matter what equation you're going to work out. Okay? It does not matter. We know, no matter what fact or figure you can bring out, benefits are going to be too generous, which is what he's arguing there. Listen, I'll take that point on its own in a second. But you can throw out, there are 10,000 people retiring every day. Benefits are more extensive than you think. The economy is not growing at the rate, traditional rate of growth. And we can expect it to stay at this rate forever. All of this has been worked into and calculated into the following conclusion by the Social Security trustees. And I would add that this conclusion is the middle conclusion of both an optimistic and a pessimistic conclusion. They have three economic models, an A, B, and C. This is the B conclusion. More often than not, the B conclusion has been conservative and pessimistic. The B conclusion is Social Security is fully funded until 2037. Following that, until 2075 at a minimum, people will get 75 to 80% of promised benefits if we do nothing. Nothing. To claim that Social Security will be a threat to other liberal priorities in the years ahead is a capitulation. Other liberal priorities will be threatened because of tax cuts to millionaires, because of defense spending, because of corporate giveaways. There is a long list of things I could give you that are going to be threats to liberal priorities. And not the least of which would be Matt Miller and people of his ilk who write this type of thing.
Sam, unrelated, it seems like the BBC is reporting that Mubarak will be speaking at 3 p.m. our time.
Right, that's tonight.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the idea that benefits are going to be increased too much, we know that 60% of Americans, even prior to this crisis, even prior to them losing their pensions, their private pensions, their value in their 401k, even prior to them having lost their jobs at age 55 or 60 and having to take reduced benefits, at age 62 because they can't get back into the workforce, even prior to the fact that those same people will have built mountains of debt going into their retirement. Even prior to these increases in premiums, which we're seeing at an astronomical rate, we know that 60% of all Americans rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income. That is also a fact. So the idea that this guy is coming out, that Matt Miller, who will not be part of that 60%, I mean that 60% of Americans, I can guarantee you that, because he would not take pen to paper and write that. Even prior to that, he is complaining that we're going to be giving too generous of benefits to people. That's insane. That is something that only someone who is living comfortably in Chevy Chase, Maryland, or wherever he lives, could write. That is only someone who is completely out of touch to the lives of the vast majority of Americans could write. And I'm not even in touch that much with what normal, with the average Americans. I'm sequestering myself in my apartment for the most part. But I can look at data. I can get emails from people who are telling me they need a free membership because, you know, they don't have the ability to make ends meet every month. And this is the only form of maintaining any type of connection with the outside world. Any form of entertainment. It's reprehensible that this guy is given an opportunity to write this stuff from the Center for American Progress, but I should invite him on the program. I think it's time to start doing some of this stuff. When we get our phone system, we're gonna invite him on the program. I want to hear him justify this to me. Fuck it. We'll try and get him on. It'll be a brief interview, I can assure you. And then, of course, I'll never get invited to be able to use the facilities at Center for American Progress, and I'll fuck myself again. Can't help it. Bikshuni, Americans have to remember that insurers can't outsource their business overseas because most countries operating on capital markets have universal health care. That is, Americans sell their risk to the insurance companies, and there is a limited amount of that risk in the U.S. population that the demand from the insurance companies. That inherently puts the American public at economic advantage. Americans have to remember that insurers can't outsource their business overseas because most of... How does that put the American public at an advantage? Because I see. Because there's only one place for these insurance industries to go to make their money. So if they're making only a 5% overhead as opposed to a 20% or a 40% or whatever, that's the only place that they'll go. But you know what? At the end of the day, we don't need insurance companies to deal with healthcare. We know the most efficient way is a single payer administered by the U.S. government. SPAYF, I would like to see all the blue states form a healthcare coalition where these populous states pool their money for a single payer system. It would be like work better than having individual states with less population going alone. Would that be legal? I don't know. If those states do use bankruptcies as a default on pensions, all public workers should call a general strike until those pensions are made whole. You know, I'm not convinced that part of demonizing a state and municipal and government workers isn't a way of sort of setting the stage for backlash against something like that. Do you remember the MTA strike in this city? That was quite a battle, and there was a lot of demonizing of those people. Post show says. Kyle, so it could be called dry bagels. Chris, join the show late. No sound on the Sammy cam. Huh. Oh, we may have an offer for a Mac Mini to replace that.
Oh, man. That would make life much better.
We are still in the market for, you know, some computers. They don't have to be crazy powerful, but Pentium-based Macs.
It should be fixed now.
And maybe we should have a list of those, like, netbooks that we could Hackintosh.
Yeah, Intel-based Macs, any of the, like, the Asus or the Dell mini netbooks, they can all be made to run Mac software.
Email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com for more information. You should get some of your Dollar District vendors to advertise with you. I don't know if we are the bulk of our audience is in this neighborhood.
I think they're doing just fine.
Yeah, that's true. That Cap guy, if he comes to your show, he may storm out of the studio and you'll get your Gallagher Marin moment. Cap, Center of American Progress. Well, we can't really have people in the studio quite yet. The story about Saudi Arabia overstating its oil reserves is in Chapter 1 of Mike Rupert's book, Crossing the Rubicon, published in 2004, and they aren't the only ones. Hmm. Interesting. I shall make a note. Mike Rupert. Crystal Count. Sam, the people who die in the cold from $2.5 billion in heating aid cuts will die knowing that they gave their lives for a brilliant long game. This sneaky Obama budget will inevitably bring Republicans around to super progressive compromise. Yes, it's a complicated death, but ultimately a very gratifying one. Well said, sir. Hi, Sam. Remember that the book, The Fourth Turning? Did you read about that? About the American prophecy of the generational constellation and where we fit into that cycle? We would be hitting the crisis period any minute. Am I weird to give that theory so much thought? I really think this world is going to explode. Can you talk me off the edge? I sort of do remember that book, The Fourth Turning.
I don't.
Can I talk you off the ledge? Well, only insofar as if we were going to hit the crisis period and there was going to be massive upheaval. The ledge is the last place you want to be. You want to be on the inside, barricaded in some interior room. That's what I could tell you. I'd like to welcome our next sponsor,
Heritage Seeds. Seeds.
We'll be selling that freeze-dried food and the seeds soon. I did try and plant some goji berries last year because I was like, what is the most nutritious foods I could possibly plant for Mila to eat if she's just reduced to berries?
So specifically berries.
Yeah. Hey, Sam, why couldn't campaign finance reform be solved by simply having the FCC require political candidates to be given ad time for free? The only reason polls have raised so much cash is for the TV expensive ads. The FCC is supposed to ensure the public airways are supposed to serve the... Well, they could do that. They could do that as a public service. Absolutely. But here is the dirty little secret. A huge amount of revenue by television stations is driven by political ads. Some astronomical number. And the lobby is just too strong. It's too strong. I mean, you'd think it would be in the best interest of politicians to do this. But yes. And, you know, actually, that's a very good question. We've got to get Lawrence Lessig on because I assume he's still working on his career. And that seems to be, that would be the one place. I mean, who cares? If Obama or, John Thune or Palin or Bloomberg have $1 billion to spend, what are they going to do? Spend it on flyers? That's a good point. That's a very good point. Very good point for a guy who handles don't be a putz. Did you see O'Donnell try and get the jackass Steve King to admit that Obama's not a Muslim? He kept up the BS, I take him at his word line. I didn't see this, no. D. Didn't catch Donald last night because Milo was in a total meltdown. Angry. Mad. It started with she was in a mood when I got home. And I said, help us set the table, please. No! I want to watch Imagination Station. You know, she's in like an after-school thing where they make like little videos. And they got a video of the last semester's Imagination Station. No! And I'm like, well, you can watch one after dinner, after you brush your teeth and you get your PJs on. But right now, you're going to help me set the table. No! Screaming. And then, you know, you got to, what am I going to do? Okay, you don't have to set the table? No, you got to. So I said, all right, you're going to go in your room. You're going to spend 2 minutes in your room until you calm down and you come out and set the table. And Nikki had to leave. And Milo is screaming. Screaming. You're the worst daddy! You're the worst parents! Come on, guys! You stink! It's the hardest thing in the world is not to start cracking up. And this thing went on forever. And then Nick had to leave, and then Milo has a meltdown because I wanted to eat with Nikki! And then she just like hits this wall where all of a sudden she's like, she's run out of anger and crying. And then she just, you know, wants a hug. And then she's just fine. She's like completely happy-go-lucky. I did at one point to try and calm her down. I did say, and this worked for like literally 30 seconds. I go, she's screaming, Nikki, you know, mommy, don't go, don't go. And I go, oh, you know, those breath stunk today? Dorsey's. And she stops and she looks at me. She goes, really? I'm like, yeah. Oh, God. And she's like, his breath really smelled? And I'm like, yes, totally. And she said, what about Evan? I said, nah, his feet stunk, though. And that lasted like 20, 30 seconds. And then just bam, right back at it. The key is you got to distract him. John Miles, haven't been able to listen to the show much lately, so I don't know how much you've been already talking about this. What do you think are the chances of getting some kind of regular gig on Current now that Oberman has partial control? I'd really like to see him build the channel into an independent progressive Tom House. Put on Tom Hartman, Democracy Now. I think there's a chance. I don't think it's a huge chance, but I think there's a chance. Who knows? Who knows? They know I'm available. Avant, focus group of Republican voters in Iowa thought Obama was a Muslim and it was affecting his policies toward Egypt. Most were spouting Beck like crap. I saw that on Ed. I caught Ed, actually, and he was showing that. Super Funk, yo, Sammy, you should definitely debate Matt Miller. I listened to that show left, right, and center. Oh, right. I've been on with him on Parker Spitzer. Yes, we went at it on Parker Spitzer a little bit. He was the one who said that we need, he actually advocated having a couple of billionaires run. I remember that. That was stunning. God, I hate that left, right, and center. And he constantly siding with big business Wall Street, even though he supposedly positioned the reasonable center. He's really center right. Campaign ads. Wasn't it a duty for the big three to carry these as a public service? I remember hearing something about that. Cedar on MSNBC? Hell yeah. What? Is there something I don't know? FCC gives license to Radio Spectrum, a natural resource, to broadcasters. Why can't they include a requirement to offer X hours of free political content and debates and whatever in the public interest? Well, they couldn't do this on cable. They don't control cable. They could do it on the broadcast networks. They could. They definitely could. They could just make it a condition of the license. Totally off topic, but watch the Reagan doc on HBO. Okay. Jarecki. Yeah, we were talking about this the other day. We want to try and get him on, right? Mark Green says, never mind about the membership. I wouldn't want anyone to find out that I'm only one level away from being you. He wants the French. It gives me the willies just thinking about it. Also, I just thought of a great guest you should have. Amanda Huganickus. Tell Evan to get you Amanda Huganickus. Who's that?
Amanda Huganickus.
Amanda Huganickus?
Is that what that is?
Yeah. Huganickus. Who's that?
You just got pranked, dude.
A man to hug and kiss.
Well, thank God I couldn't spell it. I couldn't read it right. Oberman's current show will likely premiere in late May. Yeah, I read that. The non-compete clause in his exit agreement. Yeah. He will also continue to go up Fox News, rival Bill O'Reilly. He's going to keep his time, same time slot. Yes, of course he was. Of course. States should go with single payer to attract citizens. Oh, that's a great idea, actually.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if you don't have single payer in Vermont, if that attracts people up there. I mean, you know, maybe I make the move. Take you guys up there.
I can't live in that weather.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of snow up there. I mean, you need to offset that amount of snow.
Dorsey would melt.
Morella, my granddaughter exhibits the same mildest kind of behavior when she's sleep-deprived or overstimulated. Yeah, sleep at night, sometimes she's just tired, and that's what happens. Completely out of control. Don't be a pups. There's actually still rules for equal time. That is why Paul's write books to plug. It's a loophole around equal time. Also, the debates are sponsored by third-party groups. So the networks are mere covering them as news, so equal time doesn't apply. Interesting. John Miles, I'd really like to hear... Richard Hertz, if you can get him on, and Benjamin Dover. Nice try, buddy. I thought you just mentioned it's possible you'd be added to the MSNBC line. No, yeah, you did hear that wrong. Kevin Semicol, another great guest, Yale professor Oliver. All right, folks. This is really really gotten bad. We'll see you tomorrow. Oh, I should say, on Tuesday, we'll be talking to William Grider and another guy who I used to do a show with on a show called Break Room Live. I wore him down, ladies and gentlemen. Wore him down. He's going to come on. He's going to be angry. And tomorrow we'll have a show. On Monday we'll have a show. Blah, blah, blah. Folks, don't forget, become a member if you have been listening to the show for the past 92 minutes. Live, of course, will be unsequestered for now. But if you've been listening to the show on podcast and you haven't either written me to tell me that you can't afford to pay or have not joined as a member, you better get ready. Because you hear that? It tolls for thee. Become a Majority Report member now. Donate your Twitter account for one day a week. Every day, once a day, or once a month at twitteryouraccount.com/majorityfm. Buy some coffee at justcoffee.coop. And buy your Amazon products through our link at majority.fm. See you tomorrow.